Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and this is side one of For the Record program number 670, titled Update on the Meltdown Part 3, subtitled Top Banana Republic. This program is being recorded on April 19th of the year 2009. In this program, I'm going to be reading into the record a very important article by Simon Johnson, a former administrator of the International Monetary Fund, and in the current issue of the Atlantic magazine, that's May of 2009, actually, the issue that has just come out, there is an article by Simon Johnson called The Quiet Coup. What Simon Johnson is talking about here is the hegemony that large financial institutions have over our economy. And what he does, what Simon Johnson does with his considerable experience at the International Monetary Fund is to analyze the meltdown here, the financial meltdown and the resulting and spreading economic crisis against the background of what has taken place in a number of emerging market countries in recent decades. Because indeed, Simon Johnson maintains that what we are seeing in the United States right now is a manifestation of what in the emerging markets was rather disdainfully called crony capitalism. And it is the thesis of Simon Johnson that basically the United States is in a situation now very comparable to the perilous straits in which emerging markets have found themselves in recent decades. Eastern European countries, Russia, countries in Southwest Asia, Indonesia have experienced things which, as this article will illustrate, are very similar to what we're experiencing now. Latin America also has been a frequent focal point or frequent locus of this kind of activity. It is the contention of Simon Johnson that if we do not nationalize and break up and sell off some of these banks instead of just bailing them out in a sort of hodgepodge ad hoc fashion, that we are very likely to not only find ourselves in a Great Depression too, but perhaps in an economic downturn that is worse than the Great Depression. Long-term listeners to this program are aware that really since the mid-1980s, when Reaganomics kicked in and we began running up enormous budget deficits, we were within a few years of Reagan's ascension. We had gone from being the world's biggest creditor nation to the world's biggest debtor nation. And we were shipping jobs overseas and yanking out every regulatory mainspring that had been put into place in the aftermath of the Great Depression and during the New Deal. Well, sooner or later, the chips have to fall where they must inevitably fall. And it was my contention that that would be happening then. We've had a couple of bubbles, of course, the dot-com bubble and the housing bubble and the equities bubble. However, those bubbles have quite obviously popped. And we are all of ourselves finding we're in bad shape, folks. And what Simon Johnson maintains is that if we do not change the political / economic landscape of this country in such a way as to break the enormous grip of these oligarchs and their associated institutions on our government, basically we are absolutely unequivocally effed. And it's tantamount to proposing an orderly and hopefully nonviolent revolution. And by that, it should not be misunderstood as fellow traveling. And yes, let's hoist the red flag, etc. But rather, if we do not do something to alleviate the control of these huge corporations over American political life and the financial corporations in particular, we're basically doomed. I want to emphatically refer listeners to the website, spitfirelist.com. There are a number of very important books. One of the most important is called All Honorable Men by James Stewart Martin. Time permitting, I'm going to read a couple of excerpts of that at the end of this broadcast. But I would strongly recommend that people use those old anti-fascist books, among other resources, because indeed the pattern which is manifesting itself now and which has made its impact so devastatingly felt is not new. In fact, James Stewart Martin, who was in charge of the economic warfare section of the Antitrust Division of the Department of Justice, noted in the immediate aftermath of World War II in analyzing how his team was blocked by American big business from the decartelization and economic denazification of Germany, he noted the concentration of power that was evident in this country back then in the immediate aftermath of World War II and foreshadowed much of what is taking place now. But again, that at the end of the broadcast time permitting. But do use those books. By the way, don't try to read them on your actual computer. Download them. They're very compact, easy to use PDF files. They're they're 50 years or more old, except for the Paul Manning book, and that you don't have to worry about copyrights there. So go ahead and print those books up and bind them. Put a cheap binder on them. Don't try to read them on your computer. That's ridiculous. So download them, print them up, read them, and you'll understand that the corporate state, as Mussolini referred to his fascist system, has really been ascending for a long time in this country. Now, the main focal point of this broadcast and the article which has bequeathed the subtitle to this program. Again, this is Update on the Meltdown Part 3, and this is subtitled Top Banana Republic. This article is from The Atlantic Magazine from May of 2009. It's an article by Simon Johnson. It's called The Quiet Coup. It reads, "The crash has laid bare many unpleasant truths about the United States. One of the most alarming, says a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund, is that the finance industry has effectively captured our government, a state of affairs that more typically describes emerging markets and is at the center of many emerging market crises. If the IMF staff could speak freely about the U.S., it would tell us what it tells all countries in this situation. Recovery will fail unless we break the financial oligarchy that is blocking essential reform. And if we are to prevent a true depression, we're running out of time." And then Simon Johnson goes on to write, "One thing you learn rather quickly when working at the International Monetary Fund is that no one is ever very happy to see you. Typically, your clients, unquote, come in only after private capital has abandoned them, after regional trading bloc partners have been unable to throw a strong enough lifeline, after last-ditch attempts to borrow from powerful friends like China or the European Union have fallen through. You're never at the top of anyone's dance card. The reason, of course, is that the IMF specializes in telling its clients what they don't want to hear. I should know. I pressed painful changes on many foreign officials during my time there as chief economist in 2007 and 2008, and I felt the effects of IMF pressure at least indirectly when I worked with governments in Eastern Europe as they struggled after 1989, and with the private sector in Asia and Latin America during the crises of the late 1990s and early 2000s. Over that time, from every vantage point, I saw firsthand the steady flow of officials from the Ukraine, Russia, Thailand, Indonesia, South Korea, and elsewhere, trudging to the fund when circumstances were dire and all else had failed. Every crisis is different, of course. Ukraine faced hyperinflation in 1994. Russia desperately needed help when its short-term debt rollover scheme exploded in the summer of 1998. The Indonesian rupiah plunged in 1997, nearly leveling the corporate economy. That same year, South Korea's 30-year economic miracle ground to a halt when foreign banks suddenly refused to extend new credit. But I must tell you, to IMF officials, all of these crises look depressingly similar. Each country, of course, needed a loan, but more than that, each needed to make big changes so that the loan could really work. Almost always, countries in crisis need to learn to live within their means after a period of excess. Exports must be increased and imports cut, and the goal is to do this without the most horrible of recessions. Naturally, the fund's economists spend time figuring out the policies, budget, money supply, and the like, that make sense in this context. Yet the economic solution is seldom very hard to work out. No, the real concern of the fund's senior staff and the biggest obstacle to recovery is almost invariably the politics of the countries in crisis. Typically, these countries are in a desperate economic situation for one simple reason. The powerful elites within them overreached in good times and took too many risks. Emerging market governments and their private sector allies commonly form a tight-knit and, most of the time, genteel oligarchy running the country rather like a profit-seeking company in which they are the controlling shareholders. When a country like Indonesia or South Korea or Russia grows, so do the ambitions of its captains of industry. As masters of their mini-universe, these people make some investments that clearly benefit the broader economy, but they also start making bigger and riskier bets. They reckon, correctly in most cases, that their political connections will allow them to push onto the government any substantial problems that might arise. In Russia, for instance, the private sector is now in serious trouble because over the past 5 years or so, it borrowed at least $490 billion from global banks and investors on the assumption that the country's energy sector could support a permanent increase in consumption throughout the economy. As Russia's oligarchs spent this capital, acquiring other companies and embarking on ambitious investment plans that generated jobs, their importance to the political elite increased. Growing political support meant better access to lucrative contracts, tax breaks, and subsidies. And foreign investors could not have been more pleased. All other things being equal, they prefer to lend money to people who have the implicit backing of the national governments, even if that backing gives off the faint whiff of corruption. But inevitably, emerging market oligarchs get carried away. They waste money and build massive business empires on a mountain of debt. Local banks, sometimes pressured by the government, become too willing to extend credit to the elite and to those who depend on them. Overborrowing always ends badly, whether for an individual, a company, or a country. Sooner or later, credit conditions become tighter and no one will lend you money on anything close to affordable terms. The downward spiral that follows is remarkably steep. Enormous companies teeter on the brink of default and the local banks that have lent to them collapse. Yesterday's public-private partnerships, unquote, are relabeled crony capitalism. With credit unavailable, economic paralysis ensues and conditions just get worse and worse. The government is forced to draw down its foreign currency reserves to pay for imports, service debt, and cover private losses. But these reserves will eventually run out. If the country cannot right itself before that happens, it will default on its sovereign debt and become an economic pariah. The government, in its race to stop the bleeding, will typically need to wipe out some of the national champions, now hemorrhaging cash, and usually restructure a banking system that's gone badly out of balance. It will, in other words, need to squeeze at least some of its oligarchs. Squeezing those oligarchs, though, is seldom the strategy of choice among emerging market governments. Quite the contrary. At the outset of the crisis, the oligarchs are usually among the first to get extra help from the government, such as preferential access to foreign currency, or maybe a nice tax break, or, here's a classic Kremlin bailout technique, the assumption of private debt obligations by the government. Parenthetically, of course. Simon Johnson is noting that because that's exactly what we're doing now here. Continuing, under duress, generosity toward old friends takes many innovative forms. Meanwhile, needing to squeeze someone, most emerging market governments look first to ordinary working folk, at least until the riots grow too large. Eventually, as the oligarchs in Putin's Russia now realize, some within the elite have to lose out before recovery can begin. It's a game of musical chairs. There just aren't enough currency reserves to take care of everyone, and the government cannot afford to take over private sector debt completely. So the IMF staff looks into the eyes of the Minister of Finance and decides whether the government is serious yet. The fund will give even a country like Russia a loan eventually, but first, it wants to make sure Prime Minister Putin is ready, willing, and able to be tough on some of his friends. If he is not ready to throw former pals to the wolves, the fund can wait. And when he is ready, the fund is happy to make helpful suggestions, particularly with regard to wresting control of the banking system from the hands of the most incompetent and avaricious, quote, entrepreneurs, unquote. Of course, Putin's ex-friends will fight back. They'll mobilize allies, work the system, and put pressure on other parts of the government to get additional subsidies. In extreme cases, they'll even try subversion, including calling up their contacts in the American foreign policy establishment, as the Ukrainians did with some success in the late 1990s. Many IMF programs go off track, a euphemism, precisely because the government can't stay tough on erstwhile cronies, and the consequences are massive inflation or other disasters. A program goes back on track, unquote, once the government prevails or powerful oligarchs sort out among themselves who will govern and thus win or lose under the IMF-supported plan. The real fight in Thailand and Indonesia in 1997 was about which powerful families would lose their banks. In Thailand, it was handled relatively smoothly. In Indonesia, it led to the fall of President Suharto and economic chaos. From long years of experience, the IMF staff knows its program will succeed, stabilizing the economy and enabling growth only if at least some of the powerful oligarchs who did so much to create the underlying problems take a hit. This is the problem of all emerging markets. In its depth and suddenness, the U.S. economic and financial crisis is shockingly reminiscent of moments we have recently seen in emerging markets and only in emerging markets. South Korea in 1997, Malaysia 1998, Russia and Argentina time and time again. In each of these cases, global investors, afraid that the country or its financial sector wouldn't be able to pay off mountainous debt, suddenly stopped lending. And in each case, the fear becomes self-fulfilling, as banks that couldn't roll over their debt did, in fact, become unable to pay. This is precisely what drove Lehman Brothers into bankruptcy on September 15th of 2008, causing all sources of funding to the U.S. financial sector to dry up overnight. Just as in emerging market crises, the weakness in the banking system has quickly rippled out into the rest of the economy, causing a severe economic contraction and hardship for millions of people. But there's a deeper and more disturbing similarity. Elite business interests, financiers in the case of the U.S., played a central role in creating the crisis, making ever larger gambles with the implicit backing of the government until the inevitable collapse. More alarming, they are now using their influence to prevent precisely the sorts of reform that are needed and fast to pull the economy out of its nosedive. The government seems helpless or unwilling to act against them. Top investment bankers and government officials like to lay the blame for the current crisis on the lowering of U.S. interest rates after the dot-com bust, or even better, in a bucks stop somewhere else, unquote, sort of way on the flow of savings out of China. Some on the right like to complain about Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac, or even about longer-standing efforts to promote broader home ownership. And of course, it's axiomatic to everyone that the regulators responsible for safety and soundness, unquote, were fast asleep at the wheel. But various policies, lightweight regulation, cheap money, the unwritten Chinese-American Economic Alliance, the promotion of home ownership, all had something in common. Even though some are traditionally associated with Democrats and some with Republicans, they all benefited the financial sector. Policy changes that might have forestalled the crisis but would have limited the financial sector's profits, such as Brooksley Bourne's now famous attempts to regulate credit default swaps at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission in 1998, were either ignored or swept aside. The financial industry has not always enjoyed such favored treatment, but for the past 25 years or so, finance has boomed, becoming ever more powerful. The boom began with the Reagan years, and it only gained strength with the deregulatory policies of the Clinton and George W. Bush administrations. Several other factors helped fuel the financial industry's ascent. Paul Volcker's monetary policy in the 1980s and the increased volatility in interest rates that accompanied it made bond trading much more lucrative. The invention of securitization, interest rate swaps, and credit default swaps greatly increased the volumes of transactions that bankers could make money on. And an aging and increasingly wealthy population invested more and more money in securities, helped by the invention of the IRA and the 401k plan. Together, these developments vastly increased the profit opportunities in financial services. Not surprisingly, Wall Street ran with these opportunities. From 1973 to 1985, the financial sector never earned more than 16% of domestic corporate profits. In 1986, however, that figure reached 19%. In the 1990s, it oscillated between 21 and 30%, higher than it had ever been in the post-war period. This decade, it reached 41%. Pay rose just as dramatically. From 1948 to 1982, average compensation in the financial sector ranged between 99% and 108% of the average for all domestic private industries. From 1983, it shot upward, reaching 181% in 2007. These last couple of figures again. From 1948 to 1982, average compensation in the financial sector ranged between 99% and 108% of the average for all domestic private industries. From 1983, Reagan's third year in office, it shot upward, reaching 181% in 2007. The great wealth that the financial sector created and concentrated gave bankers enormous political weight, a weight not seen in the U.S. since the era of J.P. Morgan, the man. In that period, the banking panic of 1907 could be stopped only by coordination among private sector bankers. No government entity was able to offer an effective response. But that first age of banking oligarchs came to an end with the passage of significant banking regulation in response to the Great Depression. The reemergence of an American financial oligarchy is quite recent. Of course, the U.S. is unique. Just as we have the world's most advanced economy, military, and technology, we also have its most advanced oligarchy. In a primitive political system, power is transmitted through violence or the threat of violence, military coups, private militias, and so on. In a less primitive system, more typical of emerging markets, power is transmitted via money, bribes, kickbacks, and offshore bank accounts. Although lobbying and campaign contributions certainly play major roles in the American political system, old-fashioned corruption, envelopes stuffed with $100 bills, is probably a sideshow today, Jack Abramoff notwithstanding. Instead, the American financial industry gained political power by amassing a kind of cultural capital, a belief system. Once, perhaps, what was good for General Motors was good for the country. Over the past decade, the attitude took hold that what was good for Wall Street was good for the country. The banking and securities industry has become one of the top contributors to political campaigns, but at the peak of its influence, it did not have to buy favors the way, for example, the tobacco companies or military contractors might have to. Instead, it benefited from the fact that Washington insiders already believed that large financial institutions and free-flowing capital markets were crucial to America's position in the world. One channel of influence was, of course, the flow of individuals between Wall Street and Washington. Robert Rubin, once the co-chairman of Goldman Sachs, served in Washington as Treasury Secretary under Clinton and later became chairman of Citigroup's Executive Committee. Henry Paulson, CEO of Goldman Sachs during the long boom, became Treasury Secretary under George W. Bush. John Snow, Paulson's predecessor, left to become chairman of Cerberus Capital Management, a large private equity firm that also counts Dan Quayle among its executives. Parenthetically, of course, Dan Quayle was vice president under George H.W. Bush in the early 90s and late 80s. Continuing. Alan Greenspan, after leaving the Federal Reserve, became a consultant to PIMCO, perhaps the biggest player in international bond markets. By the way, interjecting, PIMCO is also a subsidiary of Allianz, the German insurance giant, and also therefore, as one of the German core corporations, part of the Bormann Capital Network. Continuing. These personal connections were multiplied many times over at the lower levels of the past three presidential administrations, strengthening the ties between Washington and Wall Street. It has become something of a tradition for Goldman Sachs employees to go into public service after they leave the firm. The flow of Goldman alumni, including John Corzine, now the governor of New Jersey, along with Rubin and Paulson, not only placed people with Wall Street's worldview in the halls of power, it also helped create an image of Goldman Sachs, inside the Beltway at least, as an institution that was itself almost a form of public service. Wall Street is a very seductive place, imbued with an air of power. Its executives truly believe that they control the levers that make the world go round. A civil servant from Washington invited into their conference rooms, even if just for a meeting, could be forgiven for falling under their sway. Throughout my time at the IMF, I was struck by the easy access of leading financiers to the highest U.S. government officials and the interweaving of the two career tracks. I vividly remember a meeting in early 2008 attended by top policymakers from a handful of rich countries at which the chair casually proclaimed to the room's general approval that the best preparation for becoming a central bank governor was to first work as an investment banker. A whole generation of policymakers has been mesmerized by Wall Street, always and utterly convinced that whatever the bank said was true. Alan Greenspan's pronouncements in favor of unregulated financial markets are well known, yet Greenspan was hardly alone. This is what Ben Bernanke, the man who succeeded him, said in 2006. Quote, "The management of market risk and credit risk has become increasingly sophisticated. Banking organizations of all sizes have made substantial strides over the past two decades in their ability to measure and manage risks," unquote. Of course, this was mostly an illusion. Regulators, legislators, and academics almost all assumed that the managers of these banks knew what they were doing. In retrospect, they didn't. AIG's financial products division, for instance, made $2.5 billion in pre-tax profits in 2005, largely by selling underpriced insurance on complex, poorly understood securities. Often described as, quote, "picking up nickels in front of a steamroller," unquote, this strategy is profitable in ordinary years and catastrophic in bad ones. As of last fall, AIG had outstanding insurance on more than $400 billion in securities. To date, the U.S. government, in an effort to rescue the company, has committed about $180 billion in investments and loans to cover losses that AIG's sophisticated risk modeling had said were virtually impossible. Wall Street's seductive power extended even or especially to finance and economics professors, historically confined to the cramped offices of universities and the pursuit of Nobel Prizes. As mathematical finance became more and more essential to practical finance, professors increasingly took positions as consultants or partners at financial institutions. Myron Scholes and Robert Merton, Nobel laureates both, were perhaps the most famous. They took board seats at the hedge fund Long-Term Capital Management in 1994, before the fund famously flamed out at the end of the decade. But many others beat similar paths. This migration gave the stamp of academic legitimacy and the intimidating aura of intellectual rigor to the burgeoning world of high finance. As more and more of the rich made their money in finance, the cult of finance seeped into the culture at large. Works like Barbarians at the Gate, Wall Street, and Bonfire of the Vanities, all intended as cautionary tales, served only to increase Wall Street's mystique. Michael Lewis noted in Portfolio last year when he wrote Liar's Poker, an insider's account of the financial industry in 1989, he had hoped the book might provoke outrage at Wall Street's hubris and excess. Instead, he found himself, quote, knee-deep in letters from students at Ohio State who wanted to know if I had any other secrets to share. They'd read my book as a how-to manual, unquote. Even Wall Street's criminals like Michael Milken and Ivan Boesky became larger than life. In a society that celebrates the idea of making money, it was easier to infer that the interests of the financial sector were the same as the interests of the country, and that the winners in the financial sector knew better what was good for America than did the career civil servants in Washington. Faith in free financial markets grew into conventional wisdom, trumpeted on the editorial pages of the Wall Street Journal as well as on the floors of Congress. And we're going to continue with this article inside two of the program. I've been reading from an article called The Quiet Coup from the May 2009 issue of the Atlantic Monthly by Simon Johnson. Please download and print up the books that are on the Spitfire website. They'll give you some good background on this. This concludes Side 1 of For the Record program number 670. Update on the Meltdown Part 3, Top Banana Republic. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.